I'm Sam Zeff, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. As prisons in Missouri and Kansas groan under the weight of overcrowding, understaffing, and lack of funds, an expert on the German model has been making the rounds in Kansas City, talking about how their approach could make things better here. Today, what lessons we might draw from the German way. Then, the local organization that preserves the history of LGBTQ communities in the Midwest, the Gay and Lesbian Archives of Mid-America, is saving some not-so-familiar stories that connect Kansas City to gay rights and liberation, and we'll hear some of those today. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. So here's a striking image for you. A prison staff with correction officers trained in law, communication, psychology, self-defense. A prison where daily life for inmates attempts to mirror life on the outside and where humanity and rehabilitation are the most important things. According to our first guest, that's exactly how the system works in Germany. And it's led to a decrease in prison sentences for non-violent offenders and an increase in the use of probation, fines, and community service. Germany also now has an incarceration rate way fewer than the United States, 77 of every 100,000 compared to 655 in the United States. Alex Bremla is an international recognized expert in prison rehabilitation management. He spent 25 years as an administrator in Germany's largest prison in Berlin. He joins me now in the studio to explore what lessons prison systems in our part of the world might be able to learn from Germany. Axel, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to Kansas City. And I guess I'm wondering, why are you here in Kansas?
There was last Monday a very great event, the Symposium of Reaching Out from Within. I was invited to this event. It was my pleasure and also a big honor to talk to a lot of peoples. There were several panels with, I think, very experienced people talking about the prison system, of course, in America. And I also had the chance to present something what we do in Germany especially.
So these were corrections professionals, law enforcement, prosecutors,
yes,
a mix of all those?
Definitely. A lot from the correction administration, but also people, wardens, who are working the daily tasks, and many other interested people, I think also from the business side and from the social side.
I want to get into the details of how prison systems are run in Germany and other parts of Europe, but I just want to stay with this group for a moment and ask you, how are you received? I mean, are these American corrections officials open to changing the way we've done business here for 200 years?
I think what I have seen and heard and met so far, there is already something going on, and the minds are open for, I think, something new, to change something in the system. As you said, the rate is beyond the 600. Germany's rate is very... in Berlin, for example, it's 100 per 100,000. And so I think there's going, many things are already on the way, and this will change the system.
So talk about the different approach that you have in Germany and other parts of Europe, as opposed to the way we approach inmate rehabilitation or corrections here. There's very little rehabilitation in the United States. Would you suggest that that's the biggest difference?
Indeed it is. And for Germany, we have a prison act, we have a penal act, and it is the last solution to arrest somebody, to send someone to prison, especially for the juveniles, for the young people between 14 and 18 or up to 21. We have a lot of alternative measures just to keep them out from the prison, because I think everybody can understand that inside the prison it is something more like a criminal school for many who come there the first time. So we focus on this individual treatment. We have measures for different programs and competence training, anti-violence training, of course, preparation of the release. So there are many, many things which prisoners can do inside what they have broke up outside. We have, for example, we have a school and also many vocational training possibilities inside the prison. So we focus on the individual deficits of the inmates, and we check them, of course, in the first moment when they come in. Even in the on-remand prisons, we check them in competence centers, and we make a lot of assessments every 6 months to check, is there progress? Do we see progress? Is the inmate cooperating? And then they can also have benefits. Benefits means they can have a possibility to leave the facility for 5-6 hours to go out for counseling. Even they can go on leave for the weekend. But this is not from the first moment. And I also have to say the other side, what is in the law, that we have to save the society, the public, not to to bring them to new offenses. So safety of the society is always must be, and then we can check the treatment programs and if the prisoner is eligible for doing something.
I want to talk about a little bit more about the rehabilitation aspect, but first, you know, I've been in a lot of prisons and jails covering stories, and even if it's not particularly dangerous, it is bleak, it is loud, it is oppressive. And when you look at pictures and seen video of European prisons, German prisons especially, it is not at all that. Describe what it's like inside of a German prison for an inmate.
We say also that the infrastructure, the culture, how we equip the buildings, what we have outside, it has an impact on the prisoner. If we have a good environment for them, an environment where they can change their minds, where they can learn something, then it's that is positive. So we try everything to make, not only to make it comfortable. Prison should not be something comfortable, but it should be the inside condition should not differ a lot from the situation and conditions outside. And that's why we allow them to have a TV. We allow them to go on exercise, fresh air and exercise. We allow them to do sports and all these things. And the area, for example, where I come from, Berlin Tegel, it is green inside. They have trees, and it is, and they have a look out of the window and they can see it. And this is not just in the underground, something constructed without any daylight and totally separated and segregated.
You know, because I've always thought that even in the United States, almost everybody in jail or prison are going home, right? They're eventually going to be back out in society. And I've often thought that they should be turned back into society, the best version of themselves that they can be, healthy, educated, as best that they can be. Is that the aim of the German system, to turn out the best version that they can put them back in society so that they can be productive and useful?
Of course, this is the on the list. It is top to if we are successful in our treatment programs. Means we can reach the prisoner, and he is prepared for the day after. Day after means after the release. So of course we have to bring a lot of input, yeah? A lot of offers we have that he is stable. Yeah? Everybody who does not return is a success story. Yeah? And we have a recidivism rate of 35% in all over Germany the last year, very constant. So of course we have people who struggle again, and especially if they are drug addicted or whatever, they go back in the neighborhood they come from, though they are not able to change the environment and the neighborhood they come from. Of course, they will offend something new. But we start from the very beginning to prepare the release. And this is in the law, and we have to do everything, and we have to give this support to social workers, through NGOs, to voluntarily people coming in, and all this is like a package, yeah. And the inmate, of course, he has to accept this cooperation. If not, he has a choice, but then he will not get any benefits or incentives.
We're talking about the radically different approach to corrections and prisons in Germany as opposed to the United States on up-to-date. Axel Bremler, who spent 25 years administering one of Germany's largest prison, is my guest. We've got Frank from Lawrence on the line. Frank, what's your question?
So many good programs in your prisons in Germany. Do you also have a much higher ratio of staff per prisoner than we have in the U.S.? I'll take my answer off the air. Vielen Dank.
Frank, good question.
Of course, we have to fund and find enough resources to do all these programs. Social workers, psychologists, teachers, all we have, and of course the general staff, not to forget, who is there 24/7 hours just to support the prisoners, because they have problems. They have problems during the weekend. There's maybe no social worker available, but staff and all the resources is very important. Without that, I think we cannot reach our goals.
And these staff members, as we talked about at the top of the segment, well-trained and well-paid, yes?
Yes. I don't want to say of course, but they are the same paid as the police, though we have the different ranks in this, let's say, middle system, starting from A5 to A9 policemen. Also the general administration staff, the general prison service staff, they have the same salary, and this is some kind of motivation. Yeah, if they don't have enough money, so they are under motivated, and this is a problem. I know this from other countries. I was working with the UN in West Africa. I was working in Palestine with the European mission, and these guys, they get so less salary, so they are thinking the whole day, how can I make some additional money? And we don't want this. Yeah, that does not mean that we don't have any black sheep among the officers who just try to make some money to bring in all the things who are not allowed. But of course, we try to hinder them from things like this, and very less cases.
You know, in the state of Kansas, and I'm sure you've met some correction officials from Kansas, there's just a miserable time hiring and retaining correction officers in the state system. You see it also in county jails. And you've gotten around that by making it a career, paying them reasonably, and then keeping them on, so that experience filters right on down to the inmates, who in the end you're looking to service.
It starts with 24 months training.
2 years training, really.
2 years training. They have, for example, they start in the first months with a theoretical introduction. Then we take them for 3 or 4 months to facilities. They work on the job. They have in service training, and then they come back for a longer period. They get again input in security, but also in social sciences. They have to be prepared on the law. They have to know what are my tools. They get training in behavior. They get training in dynamic security. All these things are important. And after this another 5 months, they go back, and then they have a longer term of 6 or 7 months in the prison. But we change the facility. We change the regime. So they should just have a clue of everything. Though when I was in a juvenile section or in a juvenile facility, I go to a woman's prison, or I go in a remand prison, and then I'm back to the closed areas. But also we have open areas where they can work with a lower standard of security, because it's not necessary in these areas. And Berlin has 25% accommodated prisoners in the open area. That means 1,000, almost 1,000, and the other 3,000 are in the closed areas.
What do you think about private for-profit prisons?
In some way, we do this also. We outsource things, but we have some issues. We have some tasks we cannot privatize. Yeah, for example, to check and control and search prisoners, this is, in our law, it is something very special, and therefore we need very good educated officers, for example, to escort to the courts, and also to check the people, the human being, if we search something. So I think it is limited. We can provide food, we can provide other things, we can outsource this. But I think Germany has thought a long time about, shall we do this 100%? But now we just do it for things it is possible.
Is there a state or a location in America that you think is doing really well in this regard?
I'm not so deep in this prison system, but this morning I was just around here in one minimum security prison, and I think they are very good. You see, they do well, but they could do more. Yeah, and if, for example, if they were trying with really open areas that the people can go outside through the day and have an employment and go back in the evening just to sleep, you could do this, especially at this spot. They have the requirements, because you don't need this high security standard. You need less staff, because most of the inmates go for work, and they visit the family. They come just maybe for some talks with the social worker, but most of the day they are not in the facility, and this would be possible. But on the other side, It is important that the business side will employ these inmates. Yeah, not say, oh, where are you coming from? Oh, you had 5 years, something. No, thank you. Yeah, but this we have this this model, especially in Berlin, that people just can surrender themselves with an invitation from the prosecution office and go to the facility and say, here, this is what I have, 3 years, and then they can immediately, they have a check of 6 weeks, and sometimes after 1 or 1.5 weeks, they can continue the normal life. They serve a sentence, but on the other side, they go out and try as normal to continue the life with work and family, etc.
At the beginning of the segment, you talked about the meeting and that there were members of the business community there. I'd like to hear what they said to you, what your discussion with them are, and how that fits into what you just talked about employment opportunities when people get out in Germany.
I think so far what I have met, people are very open-minded in this fact, but this, it is always when, for example, the chamber, the business chamber says, okay, try to hire more prisoners, try to give them the same condition as normal people, then you have to find the right employer, yeah, who indeed takes over this responsibility. The society has the responsibility to get back these prisoners, and of course they want to lead a normal life with work and without hearing every second day, hey, you spent a sentence, you are a criminal, we are afraid, yeah? Oh no, don't move to our neighborhood, things like this. Yeah? And I can give a good example from our facility. We have vocational training for cooks, we have vocational training for car service, etc. And if they finalize these trainings, they get a certificate. And this is not a certificate where the governor signs, this is a certificate where the business chamber in Berlin signs, and they have the possibility to go out and get this certificate in an event as a quite normal people. And of course they have to go back, but my point is that restaurants, hotels, they ask, that is a foundation who offers these programs inside the prison, though they are already requested as future workers in some hotels or restaurants. So be aware, if you go to Berlin to a good restaurant, the cook might be a prisoner.
That's prison rehabilitation expert Alex Bremler from Germany, who joined me here today on Up to Date. Axel, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can find out more. He spoke, by the way, Monday at the National Symposium of Incarceration and Returning Citizens. It was hosted by Reaching Out From Within. You can find more about their work at rofw.org. Stay with us. When we return, we celebrate the work one local organization is doing to preserve and tell the history of LGBTQ community in the Midwest. I'm Sam Zeff. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Sam Zeff, in for Steve Kraske. If you didn't know it, Kraske has a weekly newsletter. You can get it by going to kcur.org/Kraske. It's a little something extra from Steve and the Up to Date team in your inbox every Monday. You can sign up at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, two men brought together by tragedy offer insides from both ends of the gun. That's Thursday on Up to Date. So from the first-of-its-kind National Planning Conference in 1966 to the drag scene of the 1970s to the lack of discrimination laws for LGBTQ individuals in Missouri, the Kansas City area has played an important role in the history of this country's gay and lesbian movement. The organization that keeps track of all of this is the Gay and Lesbian Archives of Mid-America, which this week is celebrating its 10th anniversary. Here to talk about that, Stuart Hines. He's the curator of special collections and archives for the Miller Nichols Library at UMKC. Stuart, welcome back.
Thank you.
10 years, how you celebrating?
But with a deep breath. We are having a new exhibit mounted in our gallery space there at Miller Nichols Library, and an opening reception tomorrow night from 5 to 7.
I want to know, well, let me ask you this first. How did all this get started? Why did 10 years ago, did this come together?
Well, a couple of colleagues and I had long thought about such an archive, and we found ourselves in professional positions that enabled us to make that happen. And with a gift of all of the t-shirts from the AIDS walks up to that time that was made to the Kansas City Museum, the director there, the director of archives and education at the Jackson County Historical Society, and I said, okay, let's just call this GLAMA now, and we'll make this happen. And we did, and the response from the community has far exceeded our expectations from the beginning.
Did you think you'd make it a whole decade?
I'd hope we would, but I didn't. What I didn't anticipate was that stuff would come in at the rate that it has.
Talk about that stuff. What's been rolling in?
A wide variety of material from all corners of the communities. Things that you would expect, things like organizational papers, personal collections of magazines and periodicals and T-shirts, and the ephemera of community events, but also some really kind of incredible, more personal objects, things like scrapbooks, correspondence, cartoons, condoms, all sorts of things that you wouldn't expect.
And all this is being archived and cataloged?
Yes, it's all being archived and preserved and cataloged.
And so 10 years down the road, 50 years down the road, when somebody comes to the archive, what sort of research would you think they'd be doing?
I would hope that they would be looking in part at Kansas City's role in the national narrative of LGBT rights and making their own discoveries and their own connections. That to me has been also an unanticipated delight in this project, is the way that students and other community researchers have taken this material and looked at it in ways that I never would have anticipated.
Like what?
A perfect example is the film that was done by a graduate student called The Ordnance Project that was released last summer. And it was a look at the attempt to get a non-discrimination ordinance passed in Kansas City in the early 90s. And he was a workhorse. He interviewed a number of different people, over a couple of dozen people, hours of footage, and put together this really, really incredible film.
So I want to talk a little bit about the some of the storylines that have been emerging from the archives. But first, I want to ask you about the non-discrimination ordinance that you just described. I think that there are those who would be surprised that Kansas City would be leading in the region about this. But, you know, it was in 1964 that the city was the first to pass a non-discrimination ordinance based on race. So it's not it's not unprecedented. But how did it bubble up here that resulted in that non-discrimination ordinance in Kansas City?
Well, what happened was there was the March on Washington in 1987. And that was really a powerful moment for a lot of different reasons. That's the height of the AIDS crisis, a really dark period during the AIDS crisis. And it's during the Reagan administration when there's a lot of pushback from the right. And the march was attended by about 1 million people across the country. And you see it happening in cities across the country. People come back from that march fired up, and they want to do something. And so that's when you see the emergence of a lot of civil rights organizations, and you see that happening in Kansas City. A group called Pink Triangle Political Coalition was founded in January of 88. The march was in October of 87. So it's this emerging consciousness of trying to secure civil rights for, in large part, gay and lesbian people. And so that starts this conversation, this really tangible conversation around getting an ordinance passed. And it took a while. I mean, the initiative starts, I want to say 89, formally, and then it's not until 93 that it actually passes city council, and it goes through some really ugly permutations in terms of opposition to this ordinance, and really, looking back, really, really incredible testimony opposing the efforts of those trying to get this thing passed.
Where was that opposition coming from, would you
In large part from the local religious community of all stripes, and very, very vocal, very organized, and very prominent.
Talk to me about the National Planning Conference of Homophile Organizations from 1966.
Sure, that was actually the first gathering of gay and lesbian civil rights leaders in the United States. At that point, the organized struggle for civil rights had been going since 1950, so about 16 years. And most of the organizations were on either coast, the West Coast or the East Coast, places like Los Angeles, San Francisco, Philadelphia, Washington. And they decided to meet in the middle of the country. One of the folks in San Francisco had lived in Kansas City, knew that there was an active social scene, which there was, and so they all decide to meet in the middle. It's relatively inexpensive. And they came here in February of 66 and met over the course of a weekend.
Really, where did they meet?
They met at the State Hotel down at 12th and Wyandotte.
Wow.
It's now a office building.
Yeah.
And they met in large part just to introduce themselves to each other and figure out ways to do things collectively, to sort of not duplicate effort, because most of these groups were very small, not very well resourced, and so they needed to figure out processes where they could, again, combine their efforts and have a greater impact. It was largely successful in terms of at least introductions.
But there were some tensions, though.
There were some tensions.
If I read my history correctly.
You did.
Talk to me about that.
There were some tensions just in the approach, and they were sort of a precursor to the tensions that you see in the movement at large as the decade progresses, a tension between people who were much more confrontational and people who wanted to be much more assimilationist.
Yes.
And so
the history of almost every movement, isn't it?
Precisely. I've talked about this at other groups, and when I with folks who know more about the Black civil rights movement, they say the same exact thing happened. The same thing happened with the women's movement. It seems as if it's, and I'm not a scholar of movement theory, but it seems that it is endemic to this kind of struggle that you have these different approaches, and there tends to be conflict between them.
Yeah, my colleague C.J. Janovy, who wrote No Place Like Home, and my office mate here always says that the movement needs both.
Right? Precisely.
That you need those on the radical, you know, let's burn it down now.
Right.
And those who might want to work within the system.
Yes.
Is that what we saw in this 1966 conference and moving forward?
That is what we saw in the 66 conference, and we see it really starkly in the conference that happens in 69 in Kansas City at the Hotel Belrive, Armour and Warwick, because the group came back to Kansas City, and that was 2 months after the Stonewall Rebellion. And so the militants clearly have the upper hand, and you see it reflected in the minutes of the meetings, the arguments that happen, and the push of those radicals to have their way. Yeah. And that's eventually what happens.
And the minutes and other documents are in the archive?
Yes.
Right. I want to jump ahead to 1973, a lawsuit brought against the MU Board of Curators, students from the Columbia campus in UMKC, this over the recognition for their gay rights student groups. This followed Stonewall in 1969. There was a feeling of being newly empowered. Is that what you think that drove that 73 lawsuit?
Absolutely. There, almost immediately after Stonewall, there's this release of pent-up energy among these young people to form organizations that will really push the envelope for recognition and for rights. And one of those groups was the Gay Liberation Front. And there were chapters at colleges all across the country, one of which was at MU. They called themselves Gay Liberation, and they received recognition from the student government body, but when it came to getting recognition from campus administrators and system administrators, those administrators said no. A similar group was formed in Kansas City, tried to do the same thing, the same result. And so the student groups joined forces and sued the Board of Curators. And the suit made its way through the court system. The first decision was in favor of the campus administrators. The next level up of court was in favor of the students. And then even though system administrators publicly said that they would abide by the court's rulings, in fact, they would do the exact opposite and file another suit or an appeal. And that appeal made its way to the Supreme Court, which declined to hear the case. And so the lower court ruling in favor of the students stood and set the precedent for recognition of these kinds of groups at colleges and universities across the country.
Who is paying for this lawsuit?
That's a very good question. And as I recall, the ACLU was involved. And I honestly don't know other groups who were paying for it. Mm. That's a very good question.
I want to move on to in a second to female impersonation. But before I do, I want to talk about movements generate leaders. And mm-hmm. in fact, there's no movement, any movement, without a leader. And I'm wondering, going back to this 1966 conference, 1969 conference, leaders on campus in 1973, who were the leaders that emerged from there that went on to other things?
In the homophile activism, the 60s movement, the local leader, the point person, and leader of the local advocacy organization, the Phoenix Society, was for years a gentleman named Drew Schaefer. And he attended the planning conference in 66 and made connections with all these other groups and spearheaded the effort for Kansas City to serve as the clearinghouse for all of these organizations because his dad had a printing press. So they could print the newsletters of all these groups and distribute them. So we were sort of the information central for the homophile movement. And then, you know, bless their hearts, they well-intentioned but overextended themselves. And so Drew sort of steps back after a few years of leadership at the Phoenix Society and within the NACO, the North American Conference of Homophile Organizations. He steps back. No clear identifiable leader emerges after that. And to be honest, I don't know who the student leaders were in the case against the Supreme Court.
Talk to me about female impersonation. You know, one of the things that that I've learned in the last year or so through a couple of projects is it's really important, right? It's not just frivolity, it's not just fun, but it's been important to the movement, and I want you to talk to me about that.
Well, it's been important on a number of different levels, and the most immediate that comes to mind is most of these impersonators performed at nightclubs, at bars, and bars were central to the life of the community because it was a safe space, as we would call it now. And Kansas City was known nationally as on the circuit of touring female impersonators, in large part the Jewel Box, which was the Jewel Box Lounge, which was located in the 3200 block of Troost.
Always on the, you could always tell who was at the Jewel Box because when you went to check and see what time the movie was in the newspaper when they used to put that in there, mm-hmm. there was the Jewel Box.
Absolutely.
right there with the regular movies, and it was there in every paper, and enormous number of people who came through and played that club.
Absolutely, and what's interesting about the history of that particular club is it's a large at first, and the evidence shows that drag really starts in the late 50s at that location. It opened in 45. It's just a nightclub on the strip there in that very busy business district. But
it was 13th Street, 12th Street?
No, it was always on Troost.
Troost.
Yeah, 3219 Troost.
Right.
And so that it was a very, very active business district until the end of the decade. And those performers, in large part at the beginning, drew a gay audience. And then as they become more popular and word spreads, a really large straight audience are the audience. I can't tell you how many times I've talked to folks and they tell me, oh yeah, my grandparents went to the Jewel Box all the time. Because what people would do is they drive in from Liberty or Grandview and go to dinner and then go see the funny ladies at the Jewel Box. So another club opens down the street in the very early 60s called the Colony Club. It also featured drag performers, some of the same performers who were regulars at the Jewel Box. And the Arabian Nights also opens in 62, which is now the the south end of the Costco parking lot on the Gillum side. And the Redhead over in Westport, which is now the Riot Room. So you've got a really active social scene, in large part centered around female impersonation. Some of these performers were beloved in the community. They were true community leaders as well, people like Skip Arnold. As I said, the Jewel Box in particular was known on the national circuit. It was known nationally. And, when Truman Capote was here, right, working on In Cold Blood, he would take these people from Western Kansas to the Jewel Box to shock them. Carol Channing had been there when she was in town performing. So it was a draw, and it was very well known. And then come 72, with the decline of the surrounding neighborhood, the Jewel Box moves to 3110 Main Street, where the Wendy's is at 31st and Main right now.
Talk to me about Esther Newton and her work around this issue.
Because of this very, very active social scene, Esther Newton, who was in graduate school in anthropology, comes to Kansas City and studies the scene here. And she connects with Skip Arnold, who, as it happens, was also studied anthropology. So they really hit it off as a result of that shared interest. And she wrote this scholarly treatise on her dissertation on female impersonation in the United States in using Kansas City and Chicago as her case studies. And she, in Kansas City at least, she looked at professional performers, and then the term that she used was street fairies, people who would not go all out because they couldn't afford it, but would go out on the street, maybe dressed in t-shirts and shorts, but wear eye makeup and comb their hair back, their long hair, because this is late 60s, so you're starting to see much longer hair on men. And her work sort of reports on what their lives were like as we would now call low-income folks trying to struggle to get by because they didn't make a living as female impersonators, contrasted with the folks who were on stage and did make a living, and just the differences and the approaches and the reasoning behind their presentation.
How was the scene different between Chicago and Kansas City, do you think?
I think it's a matter of density. I think they were probably pretty similar, but there was a much larger community in Chicago. There's actually a rare 45 recording of Skip Arnold doing a performance, and we have it in the collection, and it's from a performance in Chicago.
How does the drag show now at Kansas State, which is a massive performance every year, how does that, I want to say, come out of that scene in Kansas City and Chicago and other places? How are they connected, if at all, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's the continuation of the legacy of female impersonation in this country. Which dates back to the early 1800s. You first see female impersonators on the stage in this country in minstrel shows, and then in vaudeville, and then in nightclubs. And I think this the new generation of female impersonators is a continuation of that legacy, but with a really interesting 21st century spin on approach and reasoning behind their performances and assimilation. Talk about assimilation. It's really, really interesting to me to see the incorporation of children into things like drag queen story times, yeah. And children coming to the brunch shows at places like Hamburger Mary's, which, when you think it through, it's like, okay, what are their expectations going to be 20 years from now when they're an adult? What are their expectations going to be of female impersonation? How will that change the practice?
Is that the 21st century spin that you talked about, or something else?
That I think this notion of children,
of it becoming a family event,
family fair, yeah.
Right. And so look ahead 20 years and tell me what do you think?
I don't know what their expectations will be. I don't know if it's going to become. It's hard to imagine becoming even more integrated into mainstream entertainment, but that may be the case. It may lose some of its edge. It may not.
Is that a bad thing if it loses some of its edge?
I don't think so. I mean, I think a lot of, particularly performative female impersonation, is about exaggeration, and I think it always will be about exaggeration, and so there will be some sort of satirical component to it. But you see some of these performers, like on RuPaul's Drag Race, they're taking it in a really, really, really different direction. And so I don't think one will cancel out the other. I think they'll probably just coexist and find their specific audiences.
Let me propose this, that if you look 20 years down the road, and, you know, there's kids who growing up watching this on cable, families have taken them to shows here and to see live shows, wherever that is. And 20 years from now, do you think that there would still be the resistance to non-discrimination ordinances, some we've seen in Johnson County? Are we opening up the door to making us all, you know, live together a little
better?
Well,
I'd like to think that it would go away, but the backlash and the hate ebbs and flows, right? And it's hard to say which will be in 20 years from now, because it's a different world than it was 10 years ago when we started Glamma, right? So it'll be a different world 10 years from now and 10 years beyond that, and it's almost impossible to predict exactly where we'll be in terms of feeling from the community at large. But if we have some legal parameters, I think we'll be much better served.
Stuart Hines, thanks for being on Up to Date. He's the curator of special collections and archives for the Miller Nichols Library at UMKC. A new exhibit celebrating the 10th anniversary of the founding of the Gay and Lesbian Archive of Mid-America, from 5 to 7 tomorrow evening at Miller Nichols Library on the UMKC campus. More information at the UMKC Glamma Facebook page, and we'll post a link on our website, kcur.org/up-to-date. Yesterday on the program, the mayor of Edgerton in South Johnson County spoke about the services needed to accommodate the thousands of workers in that town each day. That and other conversations are at kcur.org/up-to-date. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurupto-date. I'm at Sam Zeff. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Sam Zeff. You're up to date.